Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. We have got a terrific show for you today, highlighting some really cool aspects of our local food and drink scene here in central Indiana. First, we head to Bloomington, where we'll talk with Cardinal Spirits owner Adam Quirk about launching that city's first distillery and the variety of spirits he and his team have developed over the past couple of years. We'll also talk with Adam about his collaboration with one of the world's top spice experts, Lior Lev Sirkars of La Boite in New York City, and the workshops and dinners he'll be hosting when he's in Bloomington next week. Then we head to Eat Drink Indie's kitchen space in the historic Indianapolis City Market, where we hosted a demo with Chef Andrew Whitmoyer this past week. He made an interesting Jell-O salad-type recipe from the 1970s and then recreated the dish for our audience to sample. We'll talk with Andrew about that molded limoncello chicken salad, his recreated dish, and his interest in recipes from the past. Then we'll go to Tulip Tree Creamery on Indy's Northwest Side and talk with owner and cheesemaker Fawn Smits about his background in cheesemaking and the work he's done over the years here in Indiana, and how you can learn about cheesemaking hands-on. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Cocktail scene and its focus on artisan spirits has certainly taken off here in central Indiana, and it spurred the development of craft distilleries, small artisan operations that are making handcrafted spirits. That's just what's happening in Bloomington, Indiana, where Adam Quirk and his partners at Cardinal Spirits have released more than 24 different varieties over the past 2 years, with more on the way. I talked with Adam recently in Bloomington about how he came to be operating a distillery, what it was like to launch 2 years ago, and where Cardinal Spirits is going from here.
We're about 2 years old. We opened in February of 2015, but I've been actually thinking about Cardinal Spirits for like 7 years. So when I moved back here from New York in 2010, I met my business partner, Jeff Wuslich, and we started thinking about starting a distillery. You know, it took us a few years to kind of write the business plan, and so 2013, we wrote the business plan and raised some money. In 2014, we built out the distillery. And then finally, in 2015, we opened. And we've been up and running for a couple of years now.
So why a distillery? How did that present itself as a possibility?
Well, there were no distilleries in Bloomington, which was kind of amazing. It's a college town. We have heard that people like to drink here. And so we knew that there was a market opportunity. And then just aside from that, you know, Jeff was really interested in spirits since he was, you know, basically of drinking age. He never really liked beer as much as he liked spirits and cocktails. And I came at it from an infusions background. I just, you know, since college, I've been infusing cheap booze with fruit and spices and things like that to try to make it better. When you don't have a budget, you have to kind of get creative. So I've been doing that for, you know, 12 to 15 years, something like that. So we came at it from different angles, but we both just had a passion for creating something with our hands and trying to use local ingredients to make something awesome.
So now tell me what you make at Cardinal Spirits. How many varieties of spirits are there?
So I think we've released 14 different products at this point, everything from vodka to whiskey and everything in between. I would say, you know, we definitely focus on unaged spirits at this point just because we're young. We do have stuff sitting in barrels, but it's not ready yet. And no whiskey before its time is our motto. So we have vodka, we have gin, we have a great black raspberry bramble, which is a flavored vodka. We have a couple liqueurs. Our Songbird coffee liqueur is great. A Flora, which is it's a botanical blend of hibiscus and jasmine and elderflower, and it's a great liqueur as well. So just a whole wide variety of stuff. We really have we focus on sort of intense flavors so that you don't need to add much to this to make a great cocktail.
Now, how do you come at the idea of you know, accepting the fact and pitching it to people that, hey, I'm going to open a distillery? You know, what how do you get to that point?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. There was it was a challenge, I think, to get people over the hill then when we were pitching this as a new business. But people were interested in the space because craft distilleries are fairly young. The industry is fairly young, but there's a good you can see the trend line already where it's getting ready to start picking up, just like craft brewing did in the 80s and 90s. So I think people were interested in just getting in the industry at an early stage, just like we were. And then, you know, the other piece of that, honestly, was just the marketing side. We have great branding, and we had a good plan for how to make this thing successful. And I would say, you know, half of the investors were more interested in that, the business side and the way we plan to operate, than they were the actual juice in the bottle, you know. So it helps that our stuff is delicious, but from a financial standpoint, it's not as important, actually, as, like, the operations and the planning that went into it all.
So what was the idea? How is your marketing different, or, you know, what makes it special?
Well, you know, what makes us different, I think, from a lot of other distilleries is that we do produce everything from scratch and by hand. The vast majority of vodka and whiskey that you see on the shelf is actually not made by the company that is on the label. And that's unfortunate, but we know that consumers these days are much more educated and interested in actual handmade produced products. And so that was really our pitch. We're going to do this right. We're going to make it from scratch, because neither of us were interested in starting a marketing company. We wanted to make something, you know, and so that's what we're doing. We buy raw ingredients. We ferment them here in site. We distill it. We bottle it. Everything happens here. Instead of buying neutral grain spirit or, you know, barreled whiskey or something.
So it all happens right here in Bloomington, like completely from scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we bring in raw ingredients from all over the place, but everything that actually, you know, everything that gets produced happens in this building, in these 4,400 square feet.
Now, what was it like when you opened? Kind of describe that just a little bit.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. I had a maybe 5 or 6 month old kid, and Jeff had a maybe 2 month old. So it was a hectic period of our lives, one that I think I have some post-traumatic stress from. But yeah, opening week was crazy. The first night we sold out of our vodka.
Now, how does that happen, that you completely sell out?
Yeah, you know, we underestimated demand, which is, you know, always a good thing. So yeah, around 9 or 10 o'clock that night, we just had to stand up on the bar stool and say, everybody has to go home. We have no more vodka. You drank it all. We will make more. Come back some other time.
So that was the first spirit, right? Was vodka?
Yeah. Yeah. Vodka was our first one. We released a gin shortly after. And then, yeah, they just kept cranking out after that. I had several recipes all ready to go before we opened, from my, you know, days of home and basement infusions. Yeah, we rolled out, I think, 11 spirits the first year we were open.
That seems like a lot.
Yeah, it is. It's nuts. I mean, for a distillery, that is excessive, you know. For a brewery, that's totally normal. You know, they can crank out small batches really easily, but usually distilleries are, you know, you're talking about 2 or 3 products a year, if that.
So what was the thought on rolling out so many options?
Well, so twofold. You know, we have a cocktail bar here as well, and so our bartenders were kind of tired of just drinking, you know, playing with vodka. We wanted to give them a full bar as fast as possible. So we had all these spirits, and we put the schedule together, and we just started cranking them out. You know, that takes a lot of planning on the back end, because you actually need to plan a lot of research and development time, and then you have to let it sit in the bottle for a while to make sure that nothing happens. And so it was insane. It was an insane year.
Where do you go from there when you've opened a distillery, a cocktail bar? Where do you go? I mean, are there more spirits you want to launch? You know, are there some that you have made that you don't want to make? You know, how does it, how do you keep making more?
Yeah, so from here, you know, we have a great cocktail bar. We do tours of the distillery every weekend. They're almost always sold out. It's a great place, and we love it here in Bloomington. I think next steps for us is expanding our distribution footprints to the Midwest. So we're in Kentucky, and now we're in Chicago and Nashville as of basically 2 weeks ago. So we're launching distribution in other states. We're doing that as slowly as we can, though, because we want to make sure that we're doing it right instead of just sort of the shotgun approach. So we're picking our markets, making sure we can spend time in the markets and to support our brands, you know, teach people about it. The education is a big part of craft spirits, and it's a big part of what we do as, you know, owners and our event staff, is going out and teaching people how to use this stuff.
We've been talking with Adam Quirk of Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington. We'll talk more with Adam about a very cool collaboration and some upcoming spice blending workshops when we return here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When it comes to distilled spirits like vodka or gin, you might not think about flavors and spices. But Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington, Indiana, has been working with a world-renowned spice expert to create its botanical Terra Gin. Lior Lev-Sercars of New York City's La Boite Spice Shop collaborated with Adam Quirk and the team at Cardinal Spirits on specific spices for their gin. And next week, Lior will be in Bloomington for several events. I talked with Adam recently about what it was like working with a spice expert, how the collaboration all came about, and about next week's workshops.
This year, we have a few new things coming out. So we just released a high-proof spirit called Prima Materia, and that's 190-proof white grape spirit. So that's mostly for home infusions and making bitters and things like that. Fairly small market for that, but we wanted to make it because we get a lot of requests for it. Next, I believe, is our honey spirit. So my father-in-law has an apiary in Fort Wayne with 35 hives. He sends honey down to us, and we ferment it and distill it and turn it into this really nice honey spirit. So I believe that is scheduled for either March or April. We do have an orange spirit coming out later this year. And then when Lior is here in town, we're going to be working on an Amaro with him, which is a traditional sort of European bitter spirit.
Now, tell me just briefly about Lior and your gin and how that happened.
Sure. Yeah, Lior. Lior's a great guy. He's a, I would say, you know, a world-renowned spice blender. He's based out of New York City. His company's called La Boite, which means the box in French, I just learned. And yeah, he's a chef. He's a trained chef, and his focus is on finding and blending spices. So he sources spices from all over the world, and then he knows how to blend them into these amazing mixes. I met him just basically by emailing him out of the blue in 2013 or 2012. As I was starting the distillery, I wanted to talk to him about, you know, his thought process on flavor development. And so I flew out to New York. I was going out there anyway to meet with some friends, and I stopped in his place, and we sat down, and we ended up talking for a couple hours about how to blend spices and kind of where we came from as far as developing flavors. And we just really hit it off. And so I've stayed in touch, and then last year we finally found a way to work together, and we produced this Terra Botanical Gin together. And that was a great process. You know, we had a good kickoff call where I just kind of gave him a sort of really high-level overview of what I thought the gin might be. Never really mentioned flavor or scent. I just kind of talked theoretically about where I think gin is heading, and then also about sort of what I think Indiana means in terms of, you know, wild, natural botanicals, and the scent memories that I had of growing up in southern Indiana. And he was able to somehow, through his magic, translate that into a spice blend. He sent that back to us. We distilled it. It had it was just incredible, but it had a little bit too much of a couple things. So we sent it back to him, distilled, and he agreed. He said, "Okay, let me cut down on a couple things." He sent us the second batch, and we distilled it, and it was pretty much perfect. So that's what Terra Botanical Blend is. It's just this amazing blend of wild herbs and spices that he has developed just for us for this gin, and we're really happy with it.
So tell me about what you have coming up and, you know, the spice blending camp and who it all is and all of those details.
Sure. Yeah, so coming up in, let's see, March 1st and 2nd, we have Spice Camp here at Cardinal Spirits. That's when Lior from Labatt comes to Bloomington, and he's going to entertain us and teach us, and it's going to be amazing. He's going to do an industry spice workshop just for food and beverage professionals in Indiana, and we've invited, you know, pretty much all the people that carry Cardinal Spirits as well as people who don't, who might be interested or find use in his expertise. He's going to do a spice blending presentation. He's going to talk to the people about how he sources his botanicals from all over the world, and then his sort of theories on how to blend flavors and spices. That evening, Lior is going to be working with Dave Talent to do a spice pairing dinner. And, you know, Dave is an amazing local chef. Lior has these amazing spices. They've kind of been collaborating over the past couple months now to develop this amazing menu where they are going to really highlight, like, local ingredients, but using Lior's spices to really, you know, make them taste different. And we are doing cocktail pairings with those dishes as well. And a couple of those cocktails do have the Terra gin. We're also going to be serving some of the Brooklyn Brewery project that Lior worked with. So it's going to be a really, really interesting dinner.
Now, tell me a little bit more about the gin and how the idea for the gin came about and working with Lior and why that's all kind of significant.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I wanted to work with Lior because I think he is he's incredibly talented, first of all, and I also just like collaborating with people. I think you can always you can get more out of a team than you can from any one person, and when you have a couple really sharp minds working on something, amazing things happen. So you know, working with him and our distiller Justin on this gin has been incredible, and I think the work speaks for itself. You know, the gin is just amazing. The process, you know, the process was just incredible. I think working with him actually, you know, opened up some memories in my mind of, like, what growing up in Indiana was like, and all the scent memories you have of summer and spring and fall and winter and all these different things. He was able to kind of pull those out of me and somehow translate that into a gin, which is pretty amazing.
How do you develop spirits? You know, is it, you know, a lot of this sort of thought and thinking and memories and that sort of thing? You know, how do one of these spirits come about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably different for every distillery, but for me, a lot of it is it starts with theory and just thinking about things and writing things down. I definitely believe in serendipity and you know, you happen to, you know, throw the wrong yeast into something and it turns into something great. But for the most part, you know, we produce spirits by design. We think about what we want them to be. We think about who might enjoy them, and then we build the recipe around that rather than sort of making something and then hoping that someone likes it.
What can people expect about Cardinal Spirits? You know, why is this different?
Well, you know, I'm not saying anything bad about any other distilleries, but I do think we're making some of the best spirits in the country. And I mean, our ratings actually speak to that. We're very proud of the fact that we're becoming one of the best distilleries in the country right here in Indiana. I do feel like a lot of times Hoosiers, myself included, tend to think that, like, something from far away is better than something here, just because it's from wherever, France or something. But you know, the fact of the matter is we're living in one of the biggest and best agricultural centers on the planet. So let's take advantage of that. Let's take advantage of our climate and of the incredible talent that we have here. We have really hardworking, hard-nosed individuals that are just like striving and they want to make something with their hands. So we're here to like let's take advantage of that and use that energy and make great stuff. And I think, you know, if I do everything right and our distillers do everything right, all of that shows up in the bottle. And that's what we hope for.
We've been talking with Adam Quirk of Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington. For more information on the distillery's craft spirits and events, go to cardinalspirits.com. Well, we've talked before here on Eat Drink Indie Radio about retro recipes. Those outdated dishes from the 60s and 70s that seem so odd today. Jell-O salads and other dishes that capture our attention for their unusual combinations. Well, this week we worked with Chef Andrew Whitmoyer, formerly of Indianapolis, to take on a retro recipe challenge. Make a molded Jell-O salad with canned chicken and lemon Jell-O, and then reimagine it as a much improved dish. He cooked in the demo kitchen at the historic Indianapolis City Market, and a panel of brave testers sampled both dishes. I talked with Andrew afterward about taking on our retro recipe challenge and about his fascination with dishes from the past.
So the original recipe was a mix of lemon Jell-O, juiced lemon in one of those plastic yellow lemon balls, and dry dill, chicken, canned chicken, and cucumber, green pepper, and carrot that were all horribly chopped up in a blender. It was sad.
So it was, as it turned out, it was a sort of what people might think of as a Jell-O salad.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it was a savory Jell-O salad, which I find to be the most horrible things that come out of that era, but they do it a lot.
So this was a recipe, I think, from 1973, and it was called a sweet and sour chicken mold. And it, so it was a like you would mold Jell-O, and then you turned it out of the bowl and sliced it up and served it like, I suppose, a salad.
Exactly. Yeah, it was, I think we were talking, that probably you could use crackers with it, but I think it not the right phrasing for it, but it worked well. It's on its own. Like, it didn't need the cracker, but it did work as a salad type of thing. Yeah.
So that dish was a salad sort of thing. So, but you re-envisioned a dish with those sorts of flavors, though, and that was the whole idea of taking this retro recipe, making it as written, and then re-envisioning it. So now tell me how you re-envisioned those kinds of flavors.
Well, I mean, in the recipe, like, a lot of the flavors are flavors that, you know, even though in that context are awful together, like, separately they work really well together. So lemon and dill is a classic combination, and, you know, chicken and lemon is a classic combination, and you can use vegetables with anything, so that, you know, that goes into it. But this seemed like a weird comparison, but you have shredded chicken and you have sour cream, and that gives me ideas of like tacos and Mexican food. So I mean, really, they all work together. So it was just trying to determine a way to make a dish that's modern and palatable, using those ingredients and using them in a way that chefs nowadays would use them, instead of just all mashed together in one gelatinous goop.
And that's kind of what it was. It was a gelatinous goop sort of thing. But now describe what you did with those flavors, though, because it came out beautiful. I mean, it was a beautifully modern, delicious dish.
So, I mean, it, like I said, the canned chicken, you don't really know what parts of the chicken you're getting with that. I mean, they say breast meat on it, but who knows? I mean, it could be thigh, it could be anything. So I was like, well, I like that idea, so instead of just using breast meat, I decided to use all the chicken. So I made a sous vide chicken breast and made a chicken thigh roulade and also made a very rich, like, roasted vegetable chicken stock for the chicken. And I love jello components on dishes. So I took the lemon and the jello, used some of that chicken stock, and made like a thin jello sheet as well that would go on the dish with some like fresh dill instead of the dried dill.
So it's not that gelatin is a weird thing, because it's a classic ingredient. We see, you know, all sorts of dishes in aspic, for example, back, you know, in classic cuisine. So it's, that part wasn't completely unusual.
Not at all. I mean, it's, you see a lot of, like in modernist cuisine, you see a lot of use of gels, be it a fluid gel or a thin gel sheet over the top. I personally like that technique, but you just don't see it as you did in the 70s, where it's the multicolored, like, tiered layered jello with pretzels sticking in it or whatever. Like, it's more of a refined use of that specific ingredient. So I actually enjoy using gels in any form in my cuisine, because it's a really cool component to use, and it adds a texture that you wouldn't normally see.
So the dish ended up being tell me how it ended up.
So I mean, I did a really nice thin slice of the chicken breast with this skin. I just seared the skin off in a pan to get it crispy. Same with the roulade. I just seared off the skin in a really hot pan to get the skin crispy as well, and sliced that into rings. It was essentially a duo of chicken on a plate. So the chicken roulade was paired along with a sour cream sauce that was mixed with buttermilk and lemon zest, and then just a little fresh vegetable salad of leeks and radish and greens. And then the breast was paired along with some charred carrot and that chicken sauce that I the reduced chicken stock that I made. So and then just kind of finished off with a little carrot top and chervil herb oil. So I tried to hit all the components that were in that jello mold, just again made it more refined and not you're just eating everything in one bite. Like, you can enjoy the components, but separately, or you can enjoy them all together.
So would you call it successful? You know, this sort of recreation of that retro recipe?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a good dish. I think it turned out well. As I started plating it, I changed, you know, I drew a sketch of the plate, and as I started plating it, I kind of changed the way that it ended up looking. And, as you know, some components changed as I was cooking it through the day, and had to adapt to how they came out. So I'm happy with the dish. I think it was flavorful and tasted pretty good.
Tell me why you think it's interesting using a retro recipe, or why these historic sort of recipes are interesting to you as a chef.
I find old recipes interesting. I love the history of food and how we eat today, like how we got to that point, and researching that and seeing how cuisine has changed over the years. I mean, you can just see like definitive lines where, I mean, in France it was all about decadence and lots of butter and lots of cream, and then just for some reason in the 60s and 70s, like, it was just all these horrible jello molds and
convenience foods.
Yeah, convenience foods, like foods that you could do really fast and using lots of mixes. And then, you know, today, like, I think about when I cook at home and how nothing I cook is convenient. Like, it's all very fast. But I don't know. Like, I love collecting that kind of old, like, nostalgia and looking at it and just seeing how people used to eat eat in those times. It just it baffles my mind. But at the same time, like, I love that challenge of being able to, like, look at that and say, okay, like, I kind of understand, like, the flavor combination there, and how could I change that to be something that would be enjoyed by today's palate.
We've been talking with Chef Andrew Whitmoyer, formerly of Indianapolis, who's now working in Chicago. You can follow Andrew on Facebook or look for him on Instagram. Speaking of retro recipes, I couldn't help but think of another interview I did about molded Jell-O salads. A couple of years ago, I talked with home cook Lynn Steinhauer-Habig, who recalled the 1970s and the days of ladies' lunches and those Jell-O salads that were often served. She even whipped up one of those salads made with lemon Jell-O and carrots and cottage cheese. And as we sampled it, we talked about when and why things like Jell-O salads and ladies' lunches disappeared. When did they disappear? When did we stop making Jell-O molds and Jell-O salads? Or maybe we still make them?
Well, most of what I've been talking to you about, these molds were centered around ladies who lunched, ladies who played bridge, ladies who were ladies of leisure. And those ladies of leisure went to work. That's exactly right. So everyone's working now. I mean, work outside the home. So that kind of fun meal, light meal that would accompany whatever the social event was, kind of began to disappear. And then we got a little more cognizant of health.
True. So in the 70s, when so many women went back to work, so there went your bridge club.
There went your bridge club. Your book group may have survived. It would be in the evening, but that usually brought out wine. I mean, you don't need a Jell-O mold after 5 o'clock.
That's exactly right.
Just between you and me and the mud fence.
It's tasty.
It is tasty. Well, I have to tell you, when I made it up, and my daughter was teasing me about having made this mold that she hasn't had since she was probably in the 4th grade, she said, you know, if there's any left over, we'd probably like it for dinner. She being the working woman. So I'll probably take it up there.
Well, I think it, you know, because it's interesting and different, and it, you know, it's kind of refreshing, actually.
Well, it is. Anything cold, right, you know, is refreshing and light.
Honestly, I know it has carrots in there, but it doesn't seem like a salad.
Oh, no. No, it's much more like a dessert. And with a kind of a Jell-O salad like this, the hostess, and this was very popular back in that day, would have had some sort of a stacked sandwich. There would have been Boston brown bread and maybe chicken salad and then another piece of maybe a whole wheat bread, then maybe an egg salad or a Philadelphia cream cheese pineapple mix, then another piece of bread, then a pineapple, then another piece of bread, and then it would be iced with cream cheese that had been softened with, you know, some sort of a milk product. So that would have been the main dish, and then you'd have had this. I mean, that's a lot of calories by the time.
That's a lot of calories.
That's a lot of calories. And bridge is an invigorating game, but it doesn't use much in the way of calories. But that's just the way we lived in those days. And it's kind of fun to have been thinking about the olden days.
We've been talking Jell-O salads with Indianapolis resident and home cook Lynn Steinhauer-Habig. We'll be right back with more Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Interest in artisan food here in central Indiana continues to grow, and the products you see at local farmers markets certainly speak to that. One of the foods you'll see at local markets is cheese. Mild chèvres and mozzarellas, soft, ripened cheeses, even what many refer to as stinky cheese. The demand for all sorts of artisan cheese has grown so much over the years, and cheesemaker Fawn Smith has been a part of that growth here in central Indiana. First with Trader's Point Creamery near Zionsville, then with Ludwig Farmstead Creamery in Illinois, and now with his own Tulip Tree Creamery in Indianapolis. I talked with Fonz recently about his fascination with cheesemaking, his travels around the world, and how he launched a creamery in Indianapolis.
Yeah, Tulip Tree, we are in production about 2.5 years right now. So officially, we were founded December 2013, but we made our first cheese and we sold our first cheese in June of 2014. And so that's, yeah, it's been 2.5 years and it's been going great.
Well, now tell me a little bit about your background. You've been part of the Indianapolis local food scene for a long time, right?
Yes, I think for Indianapolis right now since 2003, I've been in here in Indiana. But yeah, it's been, I've been in the dairy itself, I've been for over 25 years. Yeah, my background is I graduated in Holland at a dairy institute for in dairy food technology, specialized in dairy science, and then started traveling the world a lot, you know, and got my work experience like that. Worked in Africa for 5-6 years, worked in California for a couple of years, and did a lot of consulting in other countries like Mongolia, you know, Uganda, Malawi, Ukraine, China. So a lot of different places.
Did you know you wanted to do that? Was it something you always wanted to do?
It fascinated me. That was the key thing. And I think part of it, because I grew up in this tiny little village, you know, we had about 2,000 people there living in a village called Koudam in the southwest corner of the province of Friesland in the northern part of the Netherlands. And everything was surrounded by dairy fields. You know, it's a pasture and lots of dairy farms. A lot of my friends had, you know, were growing up on dairy farms. So I spent a lot out there. I didn't grow up in a farming family, but it always fascinated me to see what's going on. And I was always passing by this big dairy plant on my way to the bigger cities, and I was wondering, so what's going on in there? And that was my first experience, having my first practical training for 6 weeks working in a dairy plant. It was the biggest one, and it was just fascinating. And I usually played a lot and fished a lot behind the old dairy plant, which was in our village, which closed down and everything. Same thing, you know. I was fascinated by, you know, we have all these animals and we're making all these products and all these cheeses go everywhere. And that was a key thing for me. And then apart from there started the whole fascination about, see, what's other countries, what do other cultures do with these products, you know, what do they make? And I wanted to find that out, and I thought, you know, what is a better way to do that but traveling and working and get that experience like that? So that's how it all started.
Now, it's kind of universal, but then different, you know, because I assume that the cheeses in different countries are very different from each other. Did you see similarities and differences all throughout the world?
Yeah, there were a lot of different things. It's fascinating to, you know, going into a place like Mongolia, and you go to a market and they have all these dishes of milk, you know, or like made from different animals, you know, from camel milk, cow's milk, you know, yak milk. They have all these different animals, and it's kind of in an open market. And that's where I found out too, is like they were making candies out of milk. And it's, you know, but also products like cheese, of course. And it's nice to see how that is. So there's a lot of similarity between these countries because they make similar style products. But then again, it's fine-tuned to fit the climate where they are. And that was always great. I really enjoyed that. And then working in those kind of cultures then, and then see how can you, you know, help to make a certain product a little bit better. That was a key thing for me in Africa, where we, in Tanzania, when they were making a kind of a local buttermilk drink, let's say, a culture drink, which was traditionally was nothing more than milk getting sour. Of course, that was not the healthiest thing always. So what we did was then, you know, culture that in a very specific way and process it in a specific way that you got this really great product, which we called Mtindi. And it was so good. People were eating that. They were drinking it or they were using it with their meals. And that was just great. That was quite something to see, you know.
How do you end up in Indiana, though, after traveling all over the world? What brought you here?
It was very much a coincidence. I was working for a consultancy company in Holland, an international consultancy company, and everything looked great. You know, we got this house in our village, so that looked perfect. And then suddenly, after 2 years, the board of directors dissolved the whole company, and I was looking for another job. And in Holland, things are a little bit different. Even if you have a lot of experience, it might not always be so easy to find a job. And since my wife is American, we said, okay, you know what? Let's take a look at America. Let's look at the U.S. I always wanted to have a small creamery. And, of course, starting in Holland, a small creamery is, you know, you compete with a lot of them. So it's very difficult. So then, but here it's a whole different market. So that's that made it very interesting. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, you know, we had this little creamery here in Zionsville that was Traders Point at that point, wanted to start up, and they said, "Hey, you know, we're looking for somebody." They had a friend who was from the same province as I am, in Friesland, and so and they said, "Hey, you know, can we're looking for somebody?" And at that time, I just went through those people too, where they send the fax. And within 3 months, I was over here, and we talked. And I think in August we started, and that was 2003. And you know, and 3 months turned into 5-6 years, and now it's like 2017. So
that's probably where people might have first met you, with Traders Point Creamery, yes. And then saw your career grow from there. So how did the progression go from there?
Yeah, so I started with Traders Point in 2003. I worked before that. I worked in California already for Calgill Creamery, and I worked for a Dutch cheesemaker in California as well for a year. It was Bulk Farms at that point. Now it's Oakdale Cheese. So that was great. And then after Traders Point, I handed over my work, and then I said, you know what, I want to go more independent. I want to go more on my own. And that's where I helped another creamery to start up in Illinois, which was the Ludwig Farmstead Creamery. Did that for 3 years. And
we've probably seen that at the farmers markets as well.
Yeah, those products too. And, you know, since we were living in Zionsville, and we're still living in Zionsville, so our focus was first to say, okay, how can we sell those products around here? Made it a little bit easier. So we started that one up, and after 3 years of driving up and down, I thought, okay, that's enough. And during that time too, I did a lot of private consulting. I helped a lot of small other creameries in the U.S. And I had this little thing in my head, you know, where it's like people were asking me to say, when are you going to do your own thing? I've been helping others with different products, new product innovation, and solving issues and all that. And so they kept asking me, and say, when are you starting your own thing? And after a while, it became so much. And then I thought, okay, well, we don't do it now, and then, you know, we better never do it. So I thought, that was in 2013, 2014. And so, okay, let's do it. You know, everything came together. It was like the perfect timing. We got a good loan from the bank, and that's where Laura, my sales manager, and I said, okay, you know, let's do this. And Eileen, my wife, said, okay, yeah, if you don't do it now, then never talk about cheese again, something like that. And we went with it, and it has been great. You know, we really worked on those. We wanted to do something different with the products which we wanted to make. I've been making all those big wheels, and so we wanted to do something very special. The cheeses which you don't really find around here, and kind of cheeses of, you know, different regions, different countries of the world too. So that's how we came up with all these little different cheeses, the washed rind cheeses, or the stinky cheeses, how people call them, the nice bloomy rind cheese, the triple cream, like our Trillium. We have something more like an Alpine, like our Haymates, with the little wheels. So we have all these different styles of cheeses which we're now putting out, and yeah, I think it's great. You know, that's, we really want to do that.
We've been talking with Fonz Smits of Tulip Tree Creamery. We'll be back with more from Fonz, with information on the creamery's recent Good Food Award and their cheesemaking classes, here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Is good stuff happening with local food here in Central Indiana? That's what we talk about each week here on Eat Drink Indie Radio. But it's always nice when others notice it as well. Tulip Tree Creamery here in Indianapolis recently won a Good Food Award, a national competition that had more than 2,000 entrants. I talked with Tulip Tree owner and cheesemaker Fonz Smits recently about how consumers have changed over the years, about that Good Food Award, and about how you can learn the craft of cheesemaking hands-on. Have you noticed if the consumer has changed over the years that you've been making cheese, particularly here in the United States? Have they become more interested or more accepting of these, you know, different varieties that we see now?
Yeah, I do think so. Part of it is also because some of the, you know, the news stories coming out about you know, things going on with food. People are worried about some of the food they, you know, they before they were eating. They want to know what they get, which I totally agree with. I think people should know where they get their food. And I think it's absolutely great. So so there's much more bigger interest from the general public about the food. I think that can only help us create better food. It also makes it much more transparent. And the nice thing about it, too, is that it also helps a lot of these smaller food companies, something like us or Farmstead Operations. Smaller operators therefore get a bigger chance in the market to really promote the products. People are more eager in searching for those products. So there's a nice market for that.
Now, even even here at home in Indiana, you know, where you might think that people might be a little hesitant to try some of the more interesting varieties. So there's been acceptance here too.
Yeah, I totally. And I think part of that, you see that already in the market, like, you know, with supermarkets like Whole Foods coming in, you know, offering special foods. You know, you have the huge development in Indianapolis about all the different restaurants, all the chefs coming, you know. There is such a big variety coming in, and we see it on the farmers markets. The farmers markets have such a big success for us, and the restaurants really support us. People are really looking for something new, something different, and something, too, about what they can trust. And, you know, and that's the big thing for us is we're very much open about what we make. You know, we want to make an honest product, and that's why we just won a Good Food Award. As I think, you know, that's a national award, which is stands for part of it is how you produce it, but what you put into the product and everything. We won that for our Trillium, so it's a great thing.
Now, tell me a little bit more about the Trillium and the Good Food Award.
Yeah, so the Trillium is a triple cream Bloomy Rind cheese. It's a nice cheese. It's a nice mild. Usually, a lot of people like it because it's not so pungent. It's not strong flavored, but it's so nice and creamy and soft. As it ripens, it gets very nice. You know, it kind of melts on your tongue feeling, and that's how it tastes too. It's great on like if even on a burger, something like that. Eat it like that. Eat it like a slice. It goes with everything. It's perfect on a cheese plate. And that's what we entered in our the Good Food Awards for this year in January was the official awards, and I think we had to submit it already in September or something last year, and that is a national award where they, you know, a lot of creameries throughout the nation can send the products, and they kind of split up the nation in certain regions, so that's really great, and they do a blind tasting on all those products, and that's the first round. You have to get through that. So that's really about the quality of the product. After that, they do another test and see how you're actually producing the products. What is the source?
Do they have to come here?
They don't come here, but they actually look at the source of your ingredients and those kind of things. And what does the company stand for? You know, how do you handle materials? That's why we recycle the whey. We started with, you know, a farmer here who is picking up the whey now from us. We switched over some of our packing materials to be much more environmental friendly. So it's a lot about those kind of things, what you stand for as a company. You know, our farm right now, we go through the humane certification, and that's very much about how are the animals being treated. It's a very big thing. And so those are the key things with that kind of award.
Where does the milk come from? Where is the farm, and is it local? I think people wonder about that sort of thing.
Yeah, we buy milk. All our milk is coming from a family farm in Seymour, Indiana, and so it's great. The farm has been there for many, many years, and the farmer brings up the milk 3 times per week, and it's great. Like today, he was milking in the morning, and then he brings it all to us, and it's great. So it's 3 times per week he brings the fresh milk in, and yeah, and he actually, the nice thing about what he does, too, is that we pack product for him, and he sells it on the farmers markets around Seymour. Nice. So and then we actually put his name on the label as well, and that's a very big thing. So we're, as a creamery, we're not only looking for, hey, we just need a source of milk. We're looking very much at, you know, who is the farmer, how is he farming, you know, how is he managing, what kind of family, how is he treating the animals. And that kind of stuff inspires us about, okay, what kind of products, what kind of great products can we make out of that? And that makes it too. It's like our sales manager makes it her excited about sell that product, you know?
Now people can try your products at the farmers markets when they see them. It seems like you're always sampling and there's always people there. But people can also take classes and learn how to make it at home, or at least learn how you make it here. So tell me a little bit about the classes that you have at Tulip Tree.
Yeah, one of the big things which we really wanted to do with the company is about educating the people too about how these products are being made, and do that in a very informal way. But so we have a nice class setting where we have two types of classes right now. We do a fresh cheese making class where we teach people how to make mozzarella and queso blanco, and then we have an aged cheese class where we teach people how to make the gouda. And it's very hands-on. We really want people to learn how to do this, and so that they can also understand how the process goes through the step, every step of the way. Makes it a little bit easier for them if they want to try it at home. Give them little tips about it, so they learn everything about the cheese-making process. It's a really good way to get in there. And then the start, of course, part of the class is also eating a lot of cheese. So we have all our cheeses up here for people to taste. And then at the end of the class, they get to take the cheese home. Except for the aged cheese, they will get it home, but they have to wait 4 weeks. So they get a small wheel, and we'll keep it here for 4 weeks. And then, they will pick it up, and it's ready to go.
We've been talking with Fawn Smits of Tulip Tree Creamery in Indianapolis. For more information on their cheeses and where to find them, and about upcoming classes and events, go to tuliptreecreamery.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our show today, and thanks also to our guests. Adam Quirk, one of the founders of Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington, Indiana. Chef Andrew Whitmoyer, and Fawn Smits of Tulip Tree Creamery. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.